Welcome to the Reason Podcast. I'm Catherine Mangy Ward, Editor-in-Chief of Reason, and I am here interviewing Nick Gillespie, Editor-at-Large and former Editor-in-Chief of Reason, for our special 50th anniversary series with former editors. Thanks for talking with me, Nick.
Thanks for having me, Catherine. It's nice to finally get to talk about Reason.
Yeah, I know. You hardly ever have been doing that these days.
No, for I think it's October of 1993 is when I started. So do the math, because I'm an English major.
Yeah, that seems like we should maybe both skip that.
Yeah.
So, Nick, you've been doing this series of conversations with the different editors of Reason, and now is your turn on the other side of the microphone. Let's start with the question for you that you've asked others, which is, how did you first come across Reason?
So I believe I was in high school. My brother, who is older than me, 4 years older, went away to college and found Reason magazine in the college bookstore at Rutgers University or Rutgers College.
In the college bookstore's bathroom?
You know, it was back in a day, and I don't want to say it was a better day or a simpler day, because I believe all our tomorrows are our best days ever. But it was back in a day when college bookstores actually had magazine racks, and it was hard to find other magazine racks. But he found it, and it was also particularly kind of ironic, because Milton Friedman, who obviously is very important to libertarianism and to Reason and to 20th century and 21st century economic thought, had gone there as an undergrad. And it was telling, my brother was a business major or an economics major. He took a lot of econ courses, but Friedman's old dormitory was the department building for the economics department, and the top two floors were condemned because it was a very old building. But having said that, my brother started sending me Reason when I was in high school, and I started reading it. And then I also know that sometime around that period, I came across my parents' Book of the Month Club edition of Free to Choose by Milton and Rose Friedman. And I started reading that, and it was like a secret history of, you know, my God, like everything that I've been told was wrong or was off or was a very incomplete understanding of things. And, you know, those two things really excited me. And that's how I got involved in Reason, or I started reading Reason. And then, you know, I realized that Friedman and Reason, these guys are all part of a big club. And eventually, when I went to college myself, I got a subscription to Reason, which was always cheap and still remains inexpensive. You know, what's it, $14.95, $14.97 for a full year of Reason plus the website.
Thank you for that advertising placement.
Very well, nice. I also, there will be a code, so I get a 25-cent commission on each.
Reason.com/subscribe/Gillespie.
It was the one magazine that I like actually had a subscription to and kept. And then when I was in grad school, just to I graduated college in 1985. I worked in Manhattan for 3 years as a magazine editor, a teen magazine editor, a music magazine editor, a movie magazine editor. And not an hour goes by when I don't, you know, question my career choices. But I eventually went back to grad school and kept up with Reason. And I was at SUNY Buffalo working on my PhD in American literature, English literature. In, I guess, 93, and they had an advertisement for an associate or an assistant editor position, which I applied for and ended up getting.
So I always refer to you when I am talking about you to others, which I do with infuriating frequency, as a contrarian. Is that fair?
No, I don't think it is fair.
Of course, because, you realize that was a trick question.
Yeah, God damn it. Oh, God, I should have seen that one coming. And the reason I say that is I think this is part of Reason. And for me, you know, particularly thinking about it in terms of 50 years and as an institution, you know, and I know we've talked about this in various contexts, but, you know, it's something that existed long before I was part of it or I mattered in the world or anything, and it'll exist long after. And it's really, you know, it's kind of great to be in, you know, the apostolic succession of people who got to work at Reason, which made, you know, which helped create my intellectual world and my cultural understanding of culture and politics and ideas. And we'll continue on. I mean, it's both exciting and humbling. But my point of that is that Reason often is seen as a contrarian magazine because we do end up coming up with analyses or stories that are contrary to the conventional wisdom. But I don't think Reason Magazine, and I don't think I am, constitutionally contrarian. I don't look for what everybody's saying and then say, oh, I want to say something different. It's just that a lot of my interests or a lot of my thoughts, and again, I think a lot of this is informed by Reason's kind of journalistic and intellectual DNA. It leads you to a different outcome when you think about something or when you report on something or you analyze something.
Do you think that there is a contrarianism embedded in the libertarian movement more generally over and above what you just said? I mean, I often yeah. sort of think there's a certain type of person, at least, who's attracted to libertarianism and to Reason because it's not mainstream. And I don't identify with that, but I'm always interested in the power of that thread in our thought. And it seems like you might be at least proximate to it, if not a part of it.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And again, I think you're right about the movement more broadly. I don't think that necessarily applies to me, and I'll try to explain that in a second. But I do think there are a lot of people in a lot of movements that are always trying to push the envelope or be one or, they're playing three-dimensional chess with their own ideological commitment. And, as a result, it could be somebody like, Christopher Hitchens, moving towards, an embrace of abortion rights, because that will fuck up like liberal or progressive ideas of who he is or what it means to be a progressive. There are, people who go off the deep end all the time. Because they're going to the reductio ad absurdum of whatever their point of view is. And I think there's a lot of that in libertarianism, but I don't know that it's more than anything else. To go to that question of the mainstream, one of the things that I think is fascinating as a discussion point in the history and the development and evolution of Reason is Virginia Postrel, who was editor from 1989 to 2000. She's the person who hired me, and she hired any number of the people who are still at the magazine, and more than any single person professionally, really formed whatever meager talents I have in terms of writing and editing and thinking about stuff. It's really due to Virginia. I owe her an enormous debt that I, will never be able to fully make good on. One of the things that she did for the magazine, and part of this, I think, is just the evolution of the magazine, is she really made us legitimate in the eyes of what was then the mainstream media. She was a regular columnist at the Los Angeles Times. She appeared on TV shows. And I think this was back when it was on Comedy Central, Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher. And she was never the crazy person on the panel. She wasn't there next to Carrot Top and, Marlon Fitzwater or something and sounding like a nut. She was always the most I don't want to say centrist in a bad way. I mean, she was the most logical, rational, compelling, persuasive person on the panel. And she did that with the magazine, too, where she upped our journalism chops in a big way. And she pushed us into places like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times. And as cable TV grew, we showed up on places like CNN and Fox and MSNBC. And it was hugely important to the stature of the magazine, and I think the development and the reach of it. And, she was, under her stewardship, the magazine got something like four or five National Magazine Award finalist nominations, which is, like a really big fucking deal in magazine world, especially back then. And what was interesting is that she sometimes said, and in the conversation I had with her and other people will say, oh, well, she was mainstream and, I'm like alternative or punk or whatever. And I don't think that's right at all. But it is true that I don't really care about the mainstream very much. I mean, I want to know what's going on, and I like, certain types of mass media shows. I mean, I'm a gigantic Seinfeld fan. I like blockbuster movies and all of that. I don't disdain the mainstream, but it's just not that important to me. And one of the things that I was lucky when I became editor was that the concept of the mainstream as meaningful had really dissipated and had become kind of enervated by the internet, by, you know, the World Wide Web, which yeah. I think is the first time I've said that, those three words.
Those
in
words
decades.
Together, like
yeah.
that, the information but, superhighway
yeah,
that you were cruising down. Yeah. So I actually want to talk
so,
about that.
And
I want
to
talk
yeah,
about.
Cause, and I was just going to say is that, like, you know, it became hot to be, or it became normal to be alternative. And this is, you know, I liked comic books before they were, you know, kind of morally and culturally acceptable. And I always loved the X-Men, you know, and I'm thinking about reading it back in the 70s and stuff like that, because they were mutants and they were all different, but they were all part of a team at the same time. And that kind of alternativity, which is a grad school word, you know, that became normal. In, you know, in the 90s and the 2000s. And that's kind of the bliss that I follow.
So the sort of seminal piece on this, to my mind, is your 1999 essay, All Culture, All the Time, which is, I can only assume, sort of your manifesto slash audition for your editorship. You know, I don't know the backstory of how that piece specifically came about. Yeah. But one thing that's striking in rereading it is it's a piece about how it's easier than ever to make and buy culture, and how, like, the powers that be don't like that. But this is essentially, it is very nearly an internetless piece. I mean, you know, even though the internet is at this point becoming a cultural phenomenon, you know, my version of Gillespie-induced cornucopianism is so heavily informed by the internet. And to see this the thesis actually originally rolled out in this non-digital way yeah. is was sort of a little bit of a culture shock for me. Talk about, you know, did you self-consciously set out to write that piece as a big statement, or is it just that looking back you realize this was the moment that you kind of gathered up all of these threads into a big manifesto?
Yeah, the origin of that story was we were doing a Reason Weekend, our annual donor weekend, and Virginia had tasked me. She had hired me partly to kind of explore culture, you know, broadly speaking, just saying, like, okay, well, what are libertarian approaches to or understandings of or investigations into culture? Because that was more of my background. You know, I people who either listen to me talk or read my stuff over the years know that for a year I ghostwrote a column, an advice column for Teen Machine as Alyssa Milano. This is the world, my native world is, you know, crappy teen movies and pop music and stuff like that. So I was hired partly because Virginia wanted to kind of flesh out what, you know, what was the world that Reason was covering beyond politics and policy. And she also hired Chuck Freund, Charles Paul Freund, who's written, you know, in the history of Reason, you know, several of our absolutely greatest pieces, who also had a kind of cultural bent or an understanding of how culture influences politics. And, you know, when Matt Welch and I talk about politics being a lagging indicator of culture, you know, this is all part and parcel of the world we're coming in. So I was asked to put together a panel about, you know, libertarian approaches to culture, like what were we doing in the magazine? And that presentation ultimately became that article. And it is funny, I hadn't thought about it in terms of it being kind of internetless, because the web was, you know, I think by 99, like, God, the tech bubble was already about to burst. It's almost like 5 years before the second coming of Christ. It's so late in the day, but it really isn't. And some of the examples I use in that story, I think, are things like, you know, in a world of $6 DVD players, you know, all yep. things are possible. And it's like, I swear to God, I have not touched physical media in, you know, other than a USB drive. Like, I don't even know where that is, much less VHS tapes, et cetera. So,
you use the evidence of how many books how many book units move annually.
Right.
And you're talking about actual books here.
Yeah.
Of
and I can tell you, you know, I wrote that. I I guess I was in Texas. I don't know where I was living at the time, or maybe Ohio, but I can remember looking through the print copy of the statistical abstract of the United States, which, you know,
to get those numbers. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was always like, okay, and looking back, and it's, you know, you would go to the index, which was its own volume, and then like find out what volume it was in, et cetera. So it was all done kind of, you know, in this medieval technology way of using print sources and things like that. And, you know, and it's true. I mean, it just talked about the massive proliferation and multiplication of TV stations, radio stations, books being sold, even academic books, which every year in the 90s, people were writing stories about how academic presses are going out of business, but somehow they managed to publish more and more titles. And, you know, and I, the other thing, which is funny about the whole internet thing, for the presentation I gave, I wanted to start out, and I think I start the story out with this, about saying, like, whatever happened to the test pattern, which was, you know, we don't really see them anymore, I guess, except when there's an electrical disruption. But, you know, for decades on TV, at the end of the broadcasting day, they would sign off with the, you know, the Star Spangled Banner, and then the test pattern would come up to show dead air. And sometimes it was color strip, sometimes it was a kind of target. And the worst, most ridiculous one was this one that was kind of like target stuff, I guess, that you could focus the camera on, but also had like an Indian chief head on it and stuff. But I couldn't, for the presentation, and I was using PowerPoint, you know, which was relatively new at the time, to do a slideshow, I couldn't find any images of test patterns on the web. So I just asked the audience to imagine a test pattern, and, you know, and let's have 30 seconds of silence for the end of dead air in culture, you know, and it's, yeah, so.
But the, yeah, I mean, this is, I think it's a sort of great recursive example of, you know, it's hard for me to even imagine slash dimly remember a world in which a familiar image can't be called up immediately and deployed in any secondary media, right? Like that's, that's such a different world to inhabit.
I don't think we've done enough work. I mean, I don't think anybody has, because the full implications of some of this stuff are not clear of, you know, how awesome it is that everything, almost everything from the past is available at our fingertips, and more stuff is being produced every day. And, you know, part of what I was writing against in that piece and others were that people were really freaked out by that they were saying, you know, oh my God, like, where do standards go? You know, standards go to die in a world where, you know, there are suddenly a million TV stations, or anybody can make a film, or anybody can write and publish what they want, you know, on a Usenet board or something. And I was like, you know, this is like pretty fucking great. And I analogize it to the end, you know, the two kind of libertarian concepts that I brought to bear on this, which I think are still worth thinking about, was one was, this was a lot like what happened in England in the 17th century, when the laws about regulating the press, where every you know, the crown actually kept track of every printing press in the company, and every printing press had a plate on it so they could identify and torture the publisher who said the wrong things at the wrong time. Those laws broke down for a variety of reasons in 17th century England. And, you know, and there was, you know, so suddenly you had this proliferation of pamphlets and publications, high rates of literacy, and a flowering of religious freedom. And religious freedom didn't mean that people gave up on standards, or religion didn't matter anymore, or anything like that. It meant that people could finally express themselves and create the worlds that they wanted to live in, and debate and argue and mongrelize and hybridize things. And I think, you know, that's a really powerful way to look at the world we're in now. And then the other thing was James Buchanan, the, you know, recently vilified libertarian economist who created public choice and won a Nobel Prize. He talked about, you know, Albert Hirschman's Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, and that it's a good idea when, you know, he used to stress in a lot of his work that you could exit systems. And, you know, that's a good thing. And that's basically what I think cultural proliferation, or cornucopianism, as I came to call it, allowed people cultural exit. And it didn't mean they didn't want culture. It just meant they got to embrace their own culture and their own morality and things like that. And it's an incredibly liberating and better world because of that, from a specifically libertarian point of view, even though there were a lot of crusty codger, old fuss budgets in the libertarian movement who were like, oh, you know, now we're going to have a lot of poorly written sentences or, you know, shaky camera angles and stuff. But it's like, no, this is such a better world where you can buy and consume and create and watch, you know, whatever you want, whenever you want to.
And now you are the libertarian movement's crusty fuss budget.
Yes, that's right.
So congratulations on making it this far. Talk a little bit about how it is to have come into Reason at a time when it was a magazine, just a magazine, really. I mean, obviously affiliated with the Reason Foundation, but and now it is a YouTube channel and a magazine and a website and a Twitter feed, and you really shepherded it through that transition. I mean, when people say, "Oh," when people say, "Oh, what platform are we going to put this piece of content on?" Do you have these like moments of like disassociation where you're like, "We put the articles in the magazine, you millennial garbage humans"?
Well, it was, and it was Virginia who secured the first URL for Reason, I think, in like 93 or 94. And, that was good. We didn't do that much with the website during the 90s. Nobody was really quite sure what to do. And one of the things that is very funny looking back now is just that, particularly for the web, because that was the thing that really created an easy to use mass medium, was that Reason and every other magazine was like, well, you know what? We're only going to put the stuff nobody really likes online, and we'll put it out there for free because you don't want to give away the good stuff. And that, it took me a really long time to kind of work through the stupidity of that logic. And now I think, in terms of the various platforms that we have and everything, that I'm a big proponent, and I know we can argue about this and have, and I have argued with our longtime publisher, Mike Alisi, who is a kind of unsung hero to everything good about Reason. You know, everything should be up simultaneously in every format and every platform at every time, because, you know, what you're producing or what your intentions are as a producer are much less important than what the audience wants and that the audience can get it and things like that. So at
so
this
there
point,
was, there's yeah, an apocryphal, potentially apocryphal story that the initial content at Reason's website was literally just stuff that people on staff were emailing around to each other anyway? Is that true?
No. Well, you know, that was kind of the origin of Hit and Run, the blog, which, and forgive me for always forgetting, it was 2002, 2003, it might even have been 2004. I forget when we put the Hit and Run blog up. But one of the things that we were trying to do is capture internal chatter on email. And, you know, we've never had, I mean, you know, this is... one of the great things about working at Reason is that we actually live our commitments. And so, like, we never had really formalized email systems or group chats and all of that, but we would email a lot in these long strings where people would say, hey, you know, I just read this story that's pretty interesting, and I thought you guys might be, you know, curious or want to read it too. And from that kind of grew the idea of Hit and Run, which was then edited at first by Tim Cavanaugh, who had been at Suck.com, one of the web's first daily satire sites that Brian Doherty and I had written for as well. And, it was an attempt to kind of make public the conversations we were having, on a distributed basis for a widely geographically dispersed staff. And I asked people eventually to say, like, okay, you know, just throw out, you know, link to what you're reading with a couple of lines of explanation and, you know, a recommendation of like why this is good or bad or anything like that. And I guess this goes back to an earlier question or a part of the question you asked before that also I don't think we've, and when I say we, I mean, I think society hasn't fully recognized the big difference, I think, of looking back at, you know, Reason, say, 1995, when it was a monthly magazine, basically, and now is how much more work everybody on the staff is doing. And it's like, so because you're writing for a print magazine, we're still putting out the print magazine, but we're also writing every day for the website. And then we're tweeting and we're doing podcasts and we're doing videos, et cetera. And I think, you know, you can multiply that through a lot of work situations. And this is not simply in terms of like, does work ever shut off? Because I think, kind of highly productive people have always worked, you know, basically all of their waking hours. But the amount of more work we get out of most people is just immense. And it's also kind of punishing in a way. And libertarians are never supposed to speak ill of, you know, what the status quo, if it seems to be the result of technological innovation and free markets and stuff. But, we're still groping towards, you know, kind of social learning curve of how to deal with a different conception of work, which is very much not the you punch in at 8:30 and, you know, you have a 45-minute lunch break, you punch back, you know, you punch out, punch in, and then the whistle blows. And I don't think it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I do think it's a thing, and kind of figuring out how that affects people over the long term and how what are the best ways to kind of work with that? Because it's, again, I think this is a better world where work for more and more people, although probably still a minority of people, can be expressive of your deepest beliefs, your philosophy, your, kind of charitable commitments, as well as your sense of identity. These are really pretty profound issues that kind of get lost in a lot of day-to-day discussions of them.
This is also your editorship, your time at Reason also spans the journalism industry generally going from voice of God to voice of the guy with the locker next to you at school or something, right? I mean, that's a
great metaphor. Yeah,
I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing, despite the infinite number of voice of God style think pieces, proclaiming it to be such. But you know, if you look at a copy of Reason magazine from 1992, it's written in this very, you know, it's still kind of a Walter Cronkite esque product in many ways. And the fact that this evolution that you're describing, where staffers are so much more productive and have so much more expected output, that output is more and more just letting our readers and listeners and watchers into like our office chatter. I mean, this series of podcasts is a great example of that. That was something that was happening at large in journalism. It feels like maybe it happened a little faster and more consciously at Reason under you. Was that something that you thought about explicitly, or did it just evolve with the culture?
For an unrelated reason today, I was actually, and this is profoundly pretentious and stupid, but I was actually thinking, like, did Ronald Reagan change history, or did history produce Ronald Reagan? You know, and this is like a great libertarian kind of dilemma. Yeah. I was actually standing out in my pajamas on my porch in a small town, Ohio, drinking a cup of coffee. And it was, because, you know, on the one hand, libertarianism is very, I think libertarian thought is very systems based. So that the individual, ironically, is less important than the system of which they're a part. And this is somebody like the Nobel Prize winner Vernon Smith in his Behavioral Economics and Experimental Economics work. That's his pretty much his explicit, finding. Or is it, you know, libertarianism is also the kind of byproduct of Robert Heinlein and Ayn Rand and other people who are like, where you have these great figures who change history and change the world. And, you know, obviously the truth is somewhere in the middle of those. So, and that's a roundabout way of saying, you know, clearly it was a product of the time to a certain degree. But I think I consciously embraced the idea that there was a vast leveling going on between, the people on the stage, whether they were rock stars or politicians or priests or lawyers or whatever, these people in authority, and the audience or consumers or the common people that they were lecturing down to. And this is something, if you go back and look at the kind of history of post-war America in particular, you know, in technological, people who study the development of technology, particularly as it relates to communications and computers, there are competing schools of thought about, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing that communication became more and more a function of the individual, rather than the broadcaster. And, you know, this is kind of the shift from what I actually think was George Gilder, of all people, in a book called Life After Television, talked about heterarchical systems, or, you know, like a broadcast system, as being inherently totalitarian, because there's one point that's beaming everything down onto everybody else, and you're on that schedule, et cetera, to a more network-based system where everybody in the system has a fair amount of power and play and can reverse the flow of information, the flow of electricity, the flow of, you know, whatever. And so I embrace that very much so, because it seemed to me a very important aspect of what was going on. And then the flip side to that, or also in addition to that, is just the idea that I like, and this is something that I think I explicitly learned from Virginia, and if not implicitly, and other people, like when you're writing or doing, when you're presenting an argument and stuff like that, you want to give enough of your math so that somebody can come to an independent analysis of what you're doing and maybe show where you're wrong. And I think that's part of it, instead of talking like Walter Cronkite or, you know, some voice of God, say, okay, look, here are my presuppositions. This is my data set. This is why I'm thinking this way, et cetera. And giving that to the reader or to your audience, I think it's a very generous thing to do. I think it's a scary thing to do because you can be found out wrong. But I think it's the most honest, the most libertarian, and the best journalistic practice, even when it blows up in your face. And, and that I think I was conscious of.
So you've given a lot of props to Virginia, and rightly so. Is there anything that, as editor, you set out explicitly to do differently than the editors before you? I mean, I certainly labor under a pretty severe case of anxiety of influence. And, that's exacerbated by the fact that that you and Matt and Virginia and Bob and Manny are all still active in Reason. You said you don't think of yourself as a contrarian, and I don't think it makes sense necessarily to be a contrarian against one's editorial tradition. But were there things that you said at the beginning of your editorship or toward the beginning of your editorship, we're going a different way on this thing?
Yeah. I think more than anything, and this was something I just wrote a piece at Reason.com yesterday about this. This was partly because of historical contingencies, but I became editor in chief in 2000. And I think the first issue that came out under my head, under my byline, was April 2000. And I will tell a funny story about that in a second. But one of the things that I wanted to do was to kind of announce the fact that politics was less important than ever in our lives, and that was a good thing, because politics is a zero-sum game, whereas culture or all the other places where we live life and make meaning, whether it's in love, in relationships, in business, in culture, in technology, et cetera, those can infinitely expand, whereas politics ultimately is, about a zero-sum, particularly in an advanced economy where there's a general kind of equality under the law and things like that. It's a zero-sum game where, some people get to, 51% of the people get to tell 49% how to live, and you better like it. The goal of libertarianism, I think, or how I understand being a libertarian, is there are places where you need that kind of consensus and you do need that kind of, structure, but they should be squeezed down to the smallest, sphere of our human activity as possible. And at the end of the 90s, we were coming off of the collapse of the Soviet Union. We were still basking in the what was called the peace dividend, a drawdown of military spending and military conflict of major size. Bill Clinton at one point had said the era of big government was over, and all of this, there was just a lot of optimism and a lot of sense that, politics, it can be blood sport. I mean, Clinton was being deposed every other week for the last 4 years of his presidency and all that. And Newt Gingrich, who has really just been revealed to be one of history's greatest frog toads, just a horrible harpy, who just was a terrible person in many ways. There was all that, but you could check out of it. really easily.
And because so, it was the end of history, right?
Yeah,
so that was handy, as well. Like the stakes were low.
Yeah. And you know what? And obviously, you know, 9/11 changed that in a big way. Even before that, though, the 2000 election, I think, which everybody has forgotten about, but God, that was like a fucking massive story because it was essentially a tie out of, you know, hundreds or, you know, millions and millions of votes cast. It came down to, you know, a few thousand votes in a couple of states. And then, you know, this weirdo recall thing where people were looking at paper ballots. And it was, I mean, it was like something out of the Middle Ages, you know, where you're reading pieces of toast to see, is it the Virgin Mary in the toast or is it Jesus? You know, it's with the hanging chads and all of this stuff. It's bizarre. But, you know, that created a sense of unreality, I think, in politics. And also, like, wow, the stakes real. I mean, like, anything is possible. And, like, reality was kind of dissolving in front of us the more we focused on it. But certainly 9/11, you know, and then, and I think America's response to it, certainly, you know, the Patriot Act was the first sign, you know, which came out only a few weeks after the 9/11 attacks and was, you know, widely unread by anybody who signed off on it. The Patriot Act, the invasion of Afghanistan, and more importantly, the occupation of Afghanistan, which proceeds into, you know, it'll be for the next 1,000 years, I suppose, especially the move into Iraq. Like, politics came front and center because of a bunch of really bad decisions that we made. And then on top of that, you know, we ended up having a major financial crisis, again, abetted by political solutions and things like that. So it became harder to talk about culture being more important than politics, although I think we're coming out of that phase. But it's really been a 12 to 15 year detour into a highly politicized world. And this is where I really do think, and I know that people at Reason, certainly within the Reason staff and probably Reason readers are sick of hearing me say this. I mean, I think Donald Trump is the end of the line because it's not just Donald Trump. He's the effect of, you know, politicizing every aspect of everybody's everyday life, whether, you know, you're eating at Chick-fil-A or you stand or you squat when you take a piss as a man. I mean, like, this is the world we live in and it can't sustain itself because it's just so horrible and corrosive and it doesn't get us anywhere. But so I'm hopeful that we're actually moving back into a space where people rightly understand that politics is important. And there are times where you really do have to man the ramparts and, you know, take care of politics first. But we've oversaturated that. And we did starting in the early 2000s. And we really need to wake up for that and understand politics should be limited and necessary. But, you know, it's outside of politics where everything is really possible.
That period also did some very weird things to the landscape of political magazines that were still working out in many ways. I mean, we had the...
It killed the New Republic.
The New Republic is the biggest example, but I think there are others as well. Did you have a moment of, you know, as a sort of newly minted editor, did you have a moment of, you know, do we need to, as a magazine, reevaluate any of our priors or sort of revisit in particular our stance on to the extent that we had one and maybe to your mind we don't on interventionism in particular?
You know, two things. One is that I didn't resolve this. The one thing that it actually made me kind of reconsider is Reason, to my knowledge, and certainly in the whatever it's 24, 25 years that I've been associated with it, it never spoke with an editorial we. You know, we were never like, you know, we believe this and that or whatever. And it actually made me rethink that because there may be times where, you know, it makes sense to say, look, we are a unit here and we are firmly committed to X, Y, or Z. And I chose not to do that. It did not change my priors about intervention. And there was a debate, a minor one within the staff or among the staff and also about within the libertarian movement about interventionism. And again, this gets to larger questions, I think, about the libertarian movement, which, you know, runs the gamut from kind of, you know, moderate Republicans on the one side and conservatives to anarcho-capitalists you know, on the other, and everything in between. And I don't, you know, as a libertarian, I'm a small government liberal, classical liberal. I don't, you know, particularly care about anarchism or the non-aggression principle as the be-all and end-all of everything. But, you know, what was clear to me coming out of 9/11 was that Afghanistan, or the Taliban more specifically, as somebody who was abetting an enemy of America, you know, we had a right to, you know, demand something from them and to go into their country chasing a, you know, somebody who was behind an actual physical attack on American soil and people. And then, you know, after that, though, you know, really we were wrong in almost all of our commitments after that. And I, you know, part of what people looking back at now might fail to understand is how unpopular a position that was at the time, because you had even people like Todd Gitlin, who was the head of SDS for a while during the 60s. He was, you know, and now he's a tenured radical or retired tenured radical lefty, you know, nation regular, who was saying, you know, I'm going to fly the flag and we need to kill Arabs and stuff like that. I mean, it was a wrenching moment for the country. And it was really not easy to say, you know what, you know, total war against Islamofascism is a mistake, because it's not the Soviet Union. It's not the Nazis. It's not Imperial Japan. I mean, and I think it was V.S. Naipaul who had a great line where he said, like, I don't fear, you know, Islamic radicals, because they can fly planes into buildings, but they can't build planes or buildings. You know, they're not an existential threat. And so, you know, that was not a popular way to talk about it. And also, if you talked about anything in moderate tones after 9/11, even within the libertarian movement, you were seen as either, you know, aiding or abetting or are being deeply unpatriotic and almost treasonous. And I think that's where we were on a lot of these debates.
Let's switch a little bit to aesthetics. Not that that is necessarily a switch, since aesthetics are politics, our culture, our whatever. But I think the best thing ever written about you is in the New York Times Magazine profile of the libertarian moment. Nick Gillespie is to libertarianism what Lou Reed is to rock and roll, the quintessence of its outlaw spirit. For the past 20 years, Gillespie has been a writer, editor, and intellectual godfather for Reason. So, okay. So you're the Lou Reed of libertarianism. I like it. I think people, anybody who hears that sentence is totally like, yeah, that sounds about right.
That is so, you know, I mean, it is so flattering and so embarrassing.
It's the best. It's the best. You should, you know, obviously should own it. Anybody who's tuning in to Let's Talk to Nick Gillespie about Nick Gillespie for an hour is going to want to hear about two things, black leather and Pop-Tarts. So let's do it. Tell people the deep history of the jacket and what it means to you.
And I just want to say that prior to that, that profile likening me to Lou Reed, and as somebody who was born in Brooklyn but raised in New Jersey, I of course hate Long Island as a concept. It's like that Star Trek episode where the guy who's half white and half black on his face hates the other guy because they're obviously totally different. But the only thing I had written about Lou Reed prior to that, and a couple of lines that I think Matt wrote in our mutual book, was in the 1980s when I was in college. Lou Reed did an ad for Honda motor scooters, where it has Walk on the Wild Side playing, and then it cuts, and it's like this groovy New York soundstage, you know, Greenwich Village Street, and then Lou Reed's leaning on this fucking motor scooter saying, like, hey, why settle for walking? And I was like, Lou Reed is everything that is wrong with, you know, America and rock and roll and fake rebellion. But so it's kind of funny to be likened to him in any way, shape, or form, although I do enjoy him in many, many ways, and I aspire to having electroshock treatment like he did as a child. Having said all of
it's
that...
It's not too late, Nick.
Yeah, no, I know, and it's almost, you know, I'm going to microdose first, and then I'm going to, you know, because they're also kind of microdosing ECT these days, so... So the black leather jacket, it was mostly, you know, and you could look this up. I mean, before 1999, 2000 even, like, you know, I am, you know, I'm wearing every color under the sun. It was basically anything I could buy at TJ Maxx or Ross Dress for Less that was cheap and colorful and kind of fit my rapidly expanding body as I shifted from being a hard working out 6 days a week hunk to dad bod. But I realized, like, okay, I'm going to be the editor of a, you know, of a magazine that has a particular point of view. I am not willing or able to spend hundreds of dollars on good, well-tailored suits. So fuck it. I'm just going to adopt a costume, a uniform, and, you know, and it's got to be something easy and modular and like where you can buy a lot of it cheap. And that's when I started wearing jeans, black jeans all the time, most of the time a black t-shirt, and then the black leather jacket, which at the time I bought as a gift to myself for getting a big promotion. And I, you know, it was maybe like $300 or $400. And at the time, it was whatever it was by far and away the most expensive thing, article of clothing I had ever bought. And it worked. I mean, it's, you know, it helped define. You know, first off, it made my life very simple because you can find everything in black, and I didn't have to worry about you know, dry cleaning a suit jacket, which didn't fit well anyway. So that was kind of the origin of it.
That move also anticipates so many of what I see as the linchpins of the modern world and also of Reason's take on it in particular, right? You've got the kind of, okay, this is a disruptive technology idea, right? Like, don't try to be the high-end furniture store, just fucking be IKEA and people will flock to you kind of deal. Plus the idea of yourself as a brand, right? Which,
right,
you know, in our era of Instagram influencer as an actual job description, you know, that kind of thing is now taken for granted as something that all of us do consciously, but I think was much less common. Certainly for somebody who, you know, you could have easily branded yourself as, you know, Dr. Gillespie, PhD in English literature and very serious person.
Yeah. And that was, I also did lead, and I guess I haven't really talked, you know, that much about this, I guess, publicly, but it, you know, I embraced, you know, my multitudes and my contradictions. So I was, you know, yeah, I everybody who meets me for the first time within 30 seconds learns that I have a PhD and that I was an Eagle Scout, and typically that I ghost wrote a column for an advice column for Alyssa Milano back in the 80s. So it's like, I toss it out there. There's a lot, you know, that's kind of an odd path to being the editor, a serious analyst of American politics and culture. But fuck it, you know. And one of the things, the people that I was most influenced by both in college and grad school, as well as in reading and stuff, were people who, you know, it's not, they're not disdainful of tradition or of canonicity of certain types of work and certain understandings, but they also use those structures or those institutions as jumping off points to expand things. And for me, my intellectual hero, and I'm thinking of this partly because you mentioned the anxiety of influence, which of course is a phrase that is highly linked to Harold Bloom, the Yale English professor, who talked about how, you know, great writers are always in a kind of struggle with their better predecessors, and, you know, and that it's all about that kind of father versus son type of thing. I was highly influenced, and this was a guy that I worked with briefly at University of Buffalo, named Leslie Fiedler, who's about, you know, was about Bloom's age. I think it might have been a little bit older. And he was the wild man of American letters, where he rejected that kind of stuff. And he was just this great polymath who had read everything and could speak a bunch of different languages. And just, he embraced high culture and low culture equally. He wrote a fantastic essay about why, for instance, Gone with the Wind is in many ways a terrible book, and yet is one of the great achievements of American literature, because it's deeply moving, despite itself in a way. And it wasn't looking down on it. And he opened up a world of possibility to me. That is, you know, that's part of, you know, what I see. I equate that with libertarian thinking, of the idea that, you know, we are given, you know, this world where it's like going into a discount department store, and there's so many things on the rack, and you can buy all of them. And then it's our job, they're pre-made almost, and it's our job to kind of reconfigure and mix them and personalize them and individualize them by how we put them together to make the world more interesting, to make the world more expressive, to make the world more fun.
I also like the idea that there are really, I would say, probably an entire generation of libertarian journalists or would-be libertarian journalists who have kind of the Nick Gillespie on one shoulder and the Tom Wolfe on the other shoulder. Hmm. You know, both of you doing a kind of will subvert your expectations in order to get you to talk to me in an unorthodox way thing. God help us all is what
yes.
I'm saying.
Well, and there needs to be, you know, you got to throw in maybe like a Joan Didion and a Virginia Pastrell and a Catherine Mangu Ward in that too, both to genderize it, but also to create more possibilities, I think. But, you know, one of the things, just very quickly, because Wolf obviously died recently and also was like a major, major influence to me and inspiration. One of the things that I think so many people forget about him is that he, you know, he's a stylist and he reinvigorated the exclamation point in italics and dumbbells and stuff in print. But what he primarily was like a fucking great reporter, and he became expert on what he was writing about. And I find a lot of people taken by the new journalism, they mistake confessional writing for good journalism. And Wolf, in the end, like, you don't really know much about him as a person, but you do because he's actually telling you about a world that he's walking through and thinking about. And I find that endlessly important and often overlooked.
So let's talk very quickly about some of your greatest hits as editor before we talk about the future. Obviously, there is the We Know Where You Live issue. We've talked about that in other installments in this 50th anniversary conversation series. That cover and package, certainly haunts me and will haunt me forever until I find a way to outdo it. That in many ways, I think, brought Reason into a slightly higher tier of mainstream awareness. Yeah. People who had not known about the magazine before started paying attention. defend that as a stunt and also talk about how it changed Reason's fortunes.
So, that issue started as a conversation that I had with a Reason supporter named Roger Cosgrove, who's in direct mail, which is, you know, a dying art form in a lot of ways, physical mail. And he knew about these high-speed inkjet digital printers that basically could hyper-personalize, direct sales, ad copy. And he had told me about that probably a year or so before I was like, that's great. Like, we could do individualized covers. That's like pretty fantastic. And then I was looking for the story. What would we do with this? Because it's kind of a cool stunt, but what would it mean? And it took a while to kind of think through the implications of it. And we had a fantastic story by Declan McCullough, which in a lot of ways holds up. It's not that it holds up per se, but that it's incredibly relevant and prescient. And that was about how the rise of inexpensive information in the form of mostly public or easily accessible by certain people databases that contained a lot of personal information about people that people were willing to share resulted in all kinds of efficiencies so that you could get, you could get better email targeted at you. You could get better direct mail targeted at you. One of the most interesting things was basically mortgage lenders were able to they had so much more information about borrowers that it took a full percentage point off of the typical mortgage. And, you know, the difference between paying 5% and 6% on a mortgage is huge over any period of time. Was kind of great. And the idea of where we know where you live. What was funny about that was, I mean, there's always been a paranoid streak in a lot of libertarian thinking. And, when we came out with that tagline and then, personalized the covers and everything, one thing that was very funny is that we got, I don't know, you know, more than a few. I mean, it probably was a few dozen people who ended their subscription and said, like, how dare you reveal to me in a personalized cover a picture, an aerial, a high quality satellite photo of my house. How dare you? And it was kind of like, you know, we know where you live because we've been sending
you
the magazine.
You gave us your address. We've been sending stuff there.
You pay for this, you know. And so, but it was also that kind of thing. And it was that sense of surprise and shock that, like, oh, maybe I'm not in charge of privacy in the same way. That story was called something like The Upside of Zero Privacy. I think, you know, in the 15 years or 14 years, whatever it's been, since it's been published, I think we're really starting to look more closely at the downside of zero privacy and understanding, you know, just how kind of fluid a concept privacy is. And, you know, again, these are not questions necessarily that are normative, like privacy or, you know, should be this or that. It's that we live in a different world and we need to create different mindsets, temperaments, institutions, structures to navigate new questions that are raised by what is possible.
About a year and a half ago, we went through a redesign. That was the first time the magazine had been redesigned since your redesign at the beginning of your editorship. Talk about that a little bit, and you know, when you were going through that process, how did it change your thinking about the magazine, and also how the magazine related to the website, which was sort of growing at that time or starting to grow?
Yeah. And that was, I guess we launched the redesign in 2001. And shortly after I became editor, Louis Rosetta, the co-founder of Wired, got in touch with me. And it turned out that he had been personal friends with Lanny Friedlander, the originator, the creator and original editor of Reason. And he was, you know, at various points, he said that he really got into magazines because of Lanny Friedlander, which is just an immense, you know, kind of thing that nobody knew at the time, or, you know, I didn't know. And it's a really generous statement for somebody who kind of died in obscurity and whatnot. But he said, you know, you guys, you have like really good ideas, and you are, you know, you're chronicling the future, but you know, the look of the magazine just isn't there. And so he brought in two designers that he's close with, Eric Speakerman, who is, if he's known to people who are not in the kind of graphic design world, he's best known as the villain in the documentary Helvetica. He's the one guy who is like, you know, Helvetica is kind of a shitty played out font, which is awesome. He's a fantastic
character.
It's
really a great claim to fame.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's the Hannibal Lecter of typography, you know, in this documentary. And he is a fascinating guy who was raised in Germany, post-war Germany. His father had been in World War II fighting for the Germans and moved his son to Berlin, West Berlin, so that he could avoid military service in Germany, because if you lived in Berlin on the west side, you were exempt from military service because they wanted people to stay put there. And just fascinating. And his partner, Susanna Dolkinis, who's a really fantastic designer, and they had both done, you know, tons of interesting work. And what that did for me is it really simultaneously, it made me appreciate how much of a kind of well-wrought urn a good-looking magazine is. And, you know, and I think you and Joanna Andreessen, our art director, have done a fantastic job of really recapturing that idea of, you know, that a magazine is bigger than the sum of its parts, or it should be. And obviously Rosetto and Jane Metcalf, his wife and business partner who founded Wired, you know, did that in the 90s. I mean, it just, you know, Wired, we're still living in a world that Wired kind of put forward in terms of print magazines. So it made me think a lot more about how do the individual pieces fit together? What is the flow and pacing of any given issue? What are the elements? Like how, and, you know, and what's the cast of characters every issue of every magazine needs? So it was really fascinating. And as somebody who studied literature, particularly the novel and theories of aesthetics, you know, this is, you know, it's like a great exercise to walk through. I also had always kind of conceived of Reason and magazines in general, particularly political magazines, as kind of like catalogs of the world that they were talking about, or the world that they were aspirational to. So it's kind of like Reason is kind of like, you know, the L.L. Bean catalog of libertarianism. Like you should be looking through a magazine like a catalog saying like, oh, I want this, I want that. I want to live in those pictures. I want to live in those words, et cetera. So it was a really fantastic experience. At the same time, and this is, and again, I realize that you and I and you and me and Matt and, a lot of people at Reason have had, long conversations about this, and we all land in kind of different places. I also became convinced that the magazine as a, as a physical product was somewhat less important in terms of us being evangelicals for a libertarian world. Because what was happening online was that people start disaggregating content from its sources. So that, when we would get a link from Arts and Letters Daily, which back in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, or maybe Instapundit, much less the Drudge Report, like you would get a link in and it would crash the servers because there would be so much traffic coming from this one place to this one article. But people were coming in and then leaving. And in a way, the magazine is the ultimate kind of filtered curation of something. And it's a concrete physical object that gets made and then it's preserved in that one form. And I think it's really important. And I think it's really important to have not just a good looking magazine, but like one that's thought through and is very thoughtful and intentional. And I think we're, kudos to you for your editorship on this. I mean, I really think it's fantastic and it's always exciting. And because of my current position, like I generally read the magazine when subscribers get it. And I'm always like, fuck, this is a pretty good magazine. I wish I could work for it.
That's how I felt during my maternity leaves, like the 3 months of issues that I read without having been involved in their production. I was always like, this isn't bad. By the time you've done all the work yourself, you're like, who even knows? I guess at least it's done.
Yeah.
But it's then kind of a pleasure to read it fresh.
The flip side of that is, the freedom that people now have, like I was saying, you're at like that big discount store and, because everything's cheap, you can buy a lot of different things and then recombine them into whatever Frankenstein outfit you want. There's a lot of that going on and it presents a different type of challenge. And I haven't resolved, is the whole more important than the parts or, et cetera. And of course, all of these things are not mutually exclusive or anything, but I became in a lot of ways more interested in the online presence because it was, you can scale up the online presence. You can reach through weird kind of skips of a rock from one link to another. Like you can suddenly be reaching people that you would never reach with a physical magazine. But I think that's also different too, because it's, we're hitting different audiences all the time. And it's just like, people who listen to podcasts might be super libertarian, but they're never going to read a print article or they're never going to watch a video or they're never going to read an article online, and the important thing I think now, particularly if you're trying to, change the world or get more people interested in your ideas is how do you reach people where they are at? And that's and I realize I'm saying fuck a lot because it's like when I think about it, I break out into a cold sweat and it's like, you know, there are more and more places where people are congregating and you want to be there when they show up. You want to be like Squanto welcoming the pilgrims into America saying, in English, saying hi because he had been taken there as a captive and then found his way back. Like you want to be there when they open the crypt. You don't want to be there like, at the end of the line of the people getting into new territory. The other thing that I'll say about this too and about the decontextualization, recontextualization of things, and I do think it's part of the kind of journalistic ethos and ethics of Reason that we show where our stuff is coming from, our facts, our predispositions and all of that, is that we live in an extreme version of the decontextualization that Walter Benjamin was fretting over in the 30s in The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, which when I was in grad school was always talked about as the most widely cited essay written in the 20th century. And from a kind of Marxist and Freudian point of view almost, he said, there was something terrifying about mass media or about the ability to reproduce anything in different forms out of its original context. So, it used to be in the Middle Ages, if there was a painting in a church, like a fresco in the wall, it couldn't be moved and it couldn't be reproduced. You could only see it embedded in the society and the culture and the context that created it. And then suddenly in, you know, the 20th century, where you can have multiple copies of the Mona Lisa floating around and also people doodling on them and fucking it up, all bets are off. And from a Marxist point of view, you know, that loss of historization is terrifying. From a libertarian point of view, or from, I'm like, that is so great, because now I can impose my reading on everything. And I still believe that, but it's also, you know this, I mean, it's like the author is dead in a way, because people can take your words and use them however they want in any context. It's extremely liberating, but it's also, you know, it can be extremely aggravating and problematic, but it's a better world for it.
I was going to say, what is your vision for the future of your career and Reason? But it sounds like that is perhaps the vision of your of your future.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, obviously I am interruptive, not sorry enough, Nick. Yeah, no, I was gonna say, you know, that the sixth group into the Divergent series, which they cut, were the interruptives, who were just people
known fact.
But you know, one of my entry points, or you know, that's not even, I think one of the problems that I have, which a lot of people have, is that you conflate your personal tendencies or interests with, you know, libertarianism or something like that. But for me, I've always loved kind of fan generated or unauthorized culture and talking and things like that. And one of the things that was funny about working at teen magazines is that we would get and we would publish a lot of fan art. And there is some, you know, so it would be somebody like, here, you know, an 8-year-old girl saying, here's a picture I drew of Madonna, you know, or of, you know, Duran Duran, I love John Taylor, or something like that. And, you know, in a way, it's kind of a joke. And in another way, it is an incredible, part of being human, that we see things and then we want to speak back to them, or we want to write over them, and we want to, we want to do our own version of it. And I didn't realize really until after I was in grad school and I started looking at a lot of kind of audience reception theory, as well as people like, there was a particular scholar who's at USC now called Henry Jenkins, who wrote a book called Textual Poaching, which was about fan fiction, and Constance Penley is at UCSB, who read a lot about Star Trek fan fiction, of like, you know, what it means to be in a world where you both can and feel empowered to write your own version of things. And then what happened, like, and this goes back to the cultural proliferation story, up through the 90s, you could do that, but the means of doing it were kind of clumsy and clunky, and you were like dubbing VHS tapes or doing really crude versions of film. And now we have the technology where you can do that in such a supercharged, on steroids kind of way. It's really an incredible moment. And it's, you know, it's very leveling of distinctions between, you know, big studios and small players and all of that kind of stuff. And you know, if you're into participatory culture, and that's in many ways, I think libertarian idea or ideals are very much about participatory culture, not participatory democracy, which the new left was always going on about in the 60s when Reason started, but participatory culture, man, like this is the golden age, and we are not even out of the cradle yet on that kind of stuff.
So one thing that I'm actually struck by just this week in the news, there's been a bunch of coverage of how there aren't enough female Wikipedia editors, right? Like only 17% of Wikipedia editors are women or something like that. Mm-hmm. And a parallel conversation that's happening apropos of what, I don't know, but ever since Jesse Walker has like alerted me to the existence of the fan fiction culture. Mm-hmm. Apparently there's also a huge critique of fan fiction, which is that it's all uncompensated labor by women who write and, you know, read each other's stuff, but that it exists outside of the commercial sphere. And that's, you know, that's sexist too.
Yeah.
It's a funny, I think it's a very different world in which we expect this kind of collaborative, non-commercial work to have political implications or to have, you know, to sort of mean something, when before it was like really just like five guys and like some sellotape, you know, in some
ways. Yeah, no, I agree. And this is one of the things where I think we've completely exhausted 20th century categories is, you know, is on this idea of grievance and redress of, you know, of things. And there's, you know, there's no question that women have been undercompensated, treated poorly. You know, they, if, you know, 51% of the population of the world or whatever, you know, really good grievances, not against the other 49%, but, you know, of the 5 or 6% of men or, you know, in some cases, women who called all the shots and stuff like that. But this, I think that's a great, you know, contradiction of things. Like, so, you know, do you really want to mandate, you know, that all, you know, half of fan fiction needs to be written by men? Because they'll do, you know, the original Kirk Spock homosexual or homoerotic fiction was written and consumed almost exclusively by heterosexual women, which is kind of fascinating. Well, you know, why were they doing this? What did that mean? What did they get out of it? You know, but it's certainly, you know, it would be different if it was men writing Kirk Spock homoerotic fiction, I suppose.
And this is the future libertarians want, as they say on the internet.
Yeah. Well, and you know, we have it. If you want to do it, you can do it, which is pretty good. I at the same time, like, would Wikipedia be better if more different types of people were adding to it? Yeah, I think so. Would fan fiction or would fiction in general? I don't even know that I want to maintain the distinction between, you know, kind of, you know, fiction for money and fiction for audience enjoyment or something like that. Would it be better if more people felt able to participate and add a voice? Yes, I think so. And one of the things I find endlessly frustrating, and particularly in the era of Trump, is that now it's all about absolute grievance of fixating on one point, and it could be gender, it could be sexual orientation, it could be religion, it could be ethnicity, you know, and saying that describes everything. A couple of weeks or months ago, I did a podcast with Kat Murdy, who works at Cato and is a libertarian feminist, and we were talking about intersectionality, which is a buzzword, and, you know, is generally reviled by people in the libertarian world as, you know, and for some good reasons. But the idea of, you know, more than ever now, we can be multiple, we can have multiple identities that are equally important to us. So you can be a woman, you can be straight, you can be a mother, you can be a partner, you can be a business owner, you know, whatever. And the idea that we, at the same time, that things are more open than ever and we can be more multiple than ever, if that makes sense. You know, we also seem to have this urge, which is very revanchist, to say, no, this is the only thing that matters. My blackness, my feminine side, my masculinity, whatever. And I think this is where we need to be hosting a different conversation where it might, you know, and it might be that, like, oh, that's pretty interesting that, you know, so many men are willing to write for Wikipedia. What would it look like if, you know, different types of people were writing for it? What would fan fiction look like instead of talking about it as like there's some kind of, you know, numerical, you know, disjuncture going on here that we have to resolve in a really kind of top down, you know, manner, I think.
This is something as a way of thinking about what we do at Reason that I've taken from you, and you casually did it again just now, to think of it as a conversation, to think of it as a conversation that we're hosting both among the weirdos of our staff and amongst ourselves and also with our readers and listeners. This has been a lovely part of that conversation. So thank you for letting me step into the host role temporarily. I relinquish this series back to you.
And we've got a couple of good ones coming up yet. So we, you know, I mean, I'm sure that you agree with me. I mean, it is really kind of amazing that Reason has been around since 1968. And, you know, in basically we're at our peak. So I hope we're not like, I don't know, you know, the French Empire circa 1914 or something, but, you know, it's,
Jesus Christ.
It is really, you know, it's it's fantastic. And, you know, like I said, I think it's both humbling and inspiring. And to the extent that we can speak to the best possible future world, that's, you know, I mean, I we'll you know, we'll be making some use out of our lives.
Nick, you want to give us an outro as I hand the podcast back to you?
I will just say thank you, Catherine Manger Ward, for putting me through my paces and making me say out loud half-baked thoughts. So it's all on you. Please subscribe. Yes.
Podcast. Whoops. Yeah. We fell apart. You yeah. finish your own outro.
I was just going to say, please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.